Welcome back to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. Russell, it is a pleasure to have you back on the show. Would you mind reintroducing yourself to everyone out there listening?
Sure, Robbie, thanks for having me. My name is Russell Ramsey. I'm a licensed psychologist, and more to the point of my being here, my main clinical focus, it's not all I do, but has been adult ADHD. And pardon my voice, I'm getting over a bad cold. I was until my retirement on January, excuse me, July 1st, 2023, I was co-founder and co-director of the University of Pennsylvania's Adult ADHD Treatment and Research Program. And I've since that time, I've just started my own solo virtual practice, but still specializing in the assessment and psychosocial treatment, i.e., non-medical treatment of adult ADHD. But I have many good colleagues who are expert psychiatrists who can handle the medication side.
Can we just define what adult ADHD is? I know people understand the word ADHD, but then you put adult ADHD, people start wondering if it's a derivative, it's the same thing, if there's similarities, if there's differences.
Right, that's a good point. So, starting people ask, is it ADD or ADHD? Right now, the official diagnostic criteria is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Now, not everybody has the H. There's, excuse me, three presentations. You could have the predominantly inattentive profile. You have you reach the diagnostic threshold for the inattentive symptoms. Easily distracted, difficulty sustaining focus. It pulls in disorganization and things a little bit into the inattentive domain. You could have the predominantly hyperactive, impulsive presentation, which is the restlessness, fidgetiness, getting up and moving around because you have a hard time sitting still without the inattention. And that is pretty rare. That's probably the least common. Even though I saw one study that said that was the second most common, but that's the outlier study. Then there is the combined presentation, which is you meet the diagnostic threshold for both, which is the most common. The list of 18 symptoms of ADHD, combining the inattentive, hyperactive, impulsive, are the same for children as for adults. So really, when we're talking about adult ADHD, now it looks really different in children, adolescents, and adults because it used to be thought that older adolescents, or at least by young adulthood, people grew out of ADHD. But really what was happening is probably two things. One, the overt signs of hyperactivity, the restlessness, the fidgetiness, the calling out in class, with increased age and more importantly, brain maturation, even if people had a hard time sitting still, you wouldn't notice it that much. Or maybe it was a bouncy leg or a tapping pen, but things that weren't as obvious. But there was still this, when you would ask about it, or when you knew what to look for, you could tell this internal sense of restlessness. And probably the impulsivity persists a little more into adulthood in terms of impulsive spending, over talking, saying the wrong thing at the wrong time or to the wrong person, impulsive spending. And also, impulsivity is a core facet of procrastination, which is a huge problem for most individuals with ADHD, across the lifespan. The second issue related to that, growing, sometimes aging out of symptoms, and also adult roles and responsibilities are a lot different. And in some ways, and it's not creating this competition between children, adolescents, and adults. ADHD is developmental, which means it shows up as part of the diagnostic criteria. There has to be some evidence, even if collected retrospectively, that something was going on in childhood. By the book, it's by age 12, but there are strong data to say that if you notice some of these things by age 16, that's sufficient for at least for that part of the diagnosis. Even if it wasn't causing difficulties or, somebody failing out of school, but a lot of times what we'll hear people say, yeah, I never fulfilled my potential. I was a B student, but I was always rushing at the last minute. Had I got started earlier, I could have gotten A's. And various other reports that at least gave a hint that maybe ADHD was going on. Now, with adulthood, with very often for children and adolescents, it's school where there are problems that lead people to get identified and ultimately diagnosed with ADHD. Keeping, you know, because academics are like a triathlon for ADHD. Organization, time management, organizing and expressing yourself in writing, keeping up with reading assignments. But academics are a sprint, a marking period, a semester. And a lot of times that would cover up some difficulties, pulling it together at the very end, or doing well early on in the school year, then fading at the end, but then summer comes and, all right, everything's okay. Maybe we don't need the evaluation. There's no end of the school year in adulthood. And there are more and different demands, as well as the generally cultural expectation for adults having more self-control and also having responsibilities for interacting with others and being part of teams, including a co-parenting relationship, raising children, and being responsible for their children's schedules. My goodness, our pets' schedules and making sure they get their heartworm medication, being part of a work team or a stay-at-home, work-at-home parent managing children, and anybody who does that knows how hard of a job that is, and various other things where we're interdependent. Other people rely on us. So now all of a sudden, it's not just a homework with teacher and grades, but now other people, there are ripple effects. And one of the things with, it's also true with children and adolescents, but also with adults, the effects of ADHD on relationships and expectations other people might have for reciprocity or being part of a team. So those ADHD in adulthood's not really a different condition, excuse me, but we're just talking about one. For so long, it was just assumed adults did not have ADHD. So it's relatively a newcomer to the scene, probably dating back to the mid-90s, even though there was compelling research back in the mid to late 60s. Children identified with hyperactivity, there were some early studies showing it. There were some young adults still showing some symptoms and having difficulties. And the fact that many of the adult roles are very different than children and adolescents, even though we could say workplace is equivalent to school, but there's a lot more adult role responsibilities and things such as monitoring our own health over time. These tasks, which are challenged for anybody with ADHD, organizing behavior across time towards delayed goals, but there are more of those and they're more persistent and maybe some stronger and more enduring potential effects for adults, such as saving for retirement, like I said, taking care of health and taking care of other people as well.
Well, when it comes to adult ADHD, how much more do you see of them being more self-aware of their either diagnosis or whatever criteria that they might be messing with? I find myself, like, we bring up the term masking. That's a lot of self-awareness to know that you're not supposed to act in certain situations where at a time when you were a child, you might not have known what to do. So I'm sure it's multifactorial, the differences between childhood and adult ADHD, but it seems adult ADHD is probably more severe because of the fact, I mean, if you're talking about just the concept of adult ADHD, you have depression, you understand what that is. A child necessarily has depression, but might not fully understand the capabilities of it. And then you have to add the weighted factors of being an adult on top of someone who's an adult who might be undiagnosed or unmedicated ADHD, dealing with all the factors of feeling like it can't be this hard for every single person.
Right. That's a great point. No, for children and adolescents to a degree, part of the evaluation is, it starts with symptom counts. And you could somebody could have symptoms, and I'll just use with an adult, but part of the diagnosis is also having impairment. So some people, and I've done evaluations where somebody was sent in, for lack of a better phrase, because they looked really ADHD, and they might have been fast moving. Being able to, you know, big picture thinkers, but they would meet deadlines. They were never late. They weren't And usually somebody else advised them to go in. Hey, it seems like you really have ADHD. But they were generally on top of things. And they say, if this person hadn't told me that, I wouldn't be here. And they're thankful to say, okay, it's nice that I know I don't have a condition. But a lot of times people will come in because other people are noticing their difficulties. Now, as I was saying, an evaluation for children, because you know, we're reliant on our parents to provide structure, the structure of the classroom, coaches, music instructors, because at that age, I mean, we'd be trick-or-treating every day, you know, eating candy and all these things. It's, you know, parents reining us in, making sure we hold hands when we cross the street, all these things, added support for homework and things like that. So part of the evaluation is getting teacher and parent observers or other caregivers. And that's also the case in adolescents, but adolescents have a little more insight. Even though, you know, they might have different opinions too, as we know, adolescents, and we were all one at one point. Getting into adulthood, though, outside, and people might be in grad school or college, but generally what we see into the early, mid, and late 20s, as you said, people have a little more insight that they say, now that I'm outside of school and it's not the teacher or it's me with the homework or me with an internship or a job, or a dating relationship, or I don't have curfew or these other external, other determined deadlines or expectations, people are in it, at least people who eventually may get a diagnosis of ADHD might find themselves going, yeah, it's not anybody else. I'm the one showing up for late for work, because even if I set my alarm on time, I have a hard time getting out the door and I don't know where time goes. Or I tell myself I'm going to get around to it. And as much as my parents or teachers nagged, I don't get around to it. So they're increasingly, people are seeing, yeah, some of these things are not changing now. And it's not just homework, which can be important, but it's things that resonate for the individual that they say, I'm losing some friends because I'm always late, or I never gave the money for the ticket, so they didn't get me a ticket to the game or the concert. Or my relationship partners say, you know what, I can't do this anymore. You're asking me to do things for you, but I can't expect you to follow through on things for me. These sorts of things that are really the pain points that can lead people to go get support. And you mentioned masking. There are some people who may either suspect they have ADHD or have the diagnosis. And masking is actually an example of good coping. But very often when we use the term masking, we're talking about a degree of pressure, like, I can't let on how hard it is for me. I can't let everybody see that it takes me twice as long to get my work done. So I stay late. I do work on the weekends just to be on time and keep up with everybody, which again is good coping. And even working with some folks with ADHD, like college students or whatnot, it may be a fact. You know what? You're right. Your roommate can complete the assigned reading in an hour. It may take you 2 hours and you might have to go back and reread some sections. But you can still do that and get a good grade. And we just have to factor that in. And there's some other things, maybe other classes that are easier. And we just have to pay a little more attention to make sure you don't take too many writing heavy courses in the same semester. So there is some individualization and sometimes the reality that things will take longer. But with masking, people are usually not reaching out for that sort of external help for the personalization. And I think an increasingly important part is, I'll just say within the context of ADHD, normalizing this as a factor in addition to any positives and strengths. So some people who might suspect they have ADHD work harder to not let it show up out of a sense of potential. The words you hear a lot is shame or stigma, or for lack of a better phrase, just trying to fit in and be like everybody else. And sometimes those are reasonable expectations. I want to be on time. I want to hand in things by the deadline and look good for my boss. Some people might do this not knowing they have ADHD or ADHD not being on their radar screen. Individuals with ADHD sometimes will report this, especially before getting the diagnosis, of feeling like they're inadequate, less than, or otherwise, you know, feeling bad because there's something wrong with me that I can't do it like everybody else. And often, sometimes, overestimating how easy everybody else has it, because from afar, it may look effortless, but you don't see other people having to-do lists and planners, even if they don't have ADHD. But that just creates that more of that distance, that sense of distance, like, wow, I must be really bad, as opposed to, you know, ADHD is a thing to pay attention to so that you can adapt to it and use your strengths. But sometimes it's not as far away as other people as you may think. A recent study on this, I mean, recent, the past couple of weeks, at least that I ran across it. I'll say it the complex way and then the easier way and then explain it. ADHD is a quantitative difference, not a qualitative difference. The somewhat easier way to say it, it's a matter of degree, not of kind. So in my field, people would ask, well, in clinical psychology, what's like in terms of diagnoses, what's a difference that's a difference of kind? And I would say somebody who has a manic episode and bipolar disorder, excessive amounts of energy, in the midst of a manic episode, they'll take uncharacteristic risks, like somebody who doesn't gamble or typically drive recklessly, or you know, maybe indiscriminate sex or things like that. That's really uncharacteristic for them when their mood is stable. Most people don't encounter that. And it's a feature of bipolar disorder that can be treated. Somebody who might have schizophrenia and hallucinations, that would be another experience most people don't have. So that would be a difference of kind. And still these, you know, people with these diagnoses have many strengths, and that's what treatment can help with. Another way to think about it, and what this study provided some data on, ADHD falls along a dimension. So if I'm asked to define, well, what is ADHD? It's much more than the A and the H, the attention, hyperactivity, and I'll pull in the impulsivity there. They're not wrong, but that single list of 18 symptoms, it's incomplete. And a line that Russell Barkley would have on this, one of the leading figures in ADHD in terms of evidence-supported information and research and everything else, he would say calling ADHD an attention problem is like calling autism eye gaze disorder, which is a facet of autistic spectrum disorders, difficulty keeping eye contact, but it doesn't explain everything. It's one piece. So within ADHD, we think about it as a neurodevelopmental syndrome. Neurodevelopmental, there since childhood, it's just part of you. Syndrome, it's not like type 1 and type 2 diabetes. It's a collection of symptoms that also must directly cause impairments, life difficulties. So like I said, some people might look really ADHD, for lack of a better phrase. They have symptoms or some symptoms, but it's not causing problems for them. Neurodevelopmental syndrome of impaired or at least inefficient self-regulation. And self-regulation meaning, one of the buzz phrases to describe self-regulation is what is called the concept of the executive functions. These are the suite of skills that we use to manage ourselves. So if you've ever woken up to an alarm you set, that's self-regulation. If you know you can't have a box of chocolate chip cookies in the house without eating it all at 11:03 p.m. at night, after all day looking at it and not eating it, not eating it, not eating it, that is self-regulation. If you put something by the door to remember to take it with you the next day, that's self-regulation. How do we manage ourselves? And it can be things like, I feel like going home after work, but I know if I get to the gym right away, I'll complete my workout. So neurodevelopmental syndrome of impaired self-regulation, i.e. the executive functions. In case it's not 100% clear, we all have executive functions. It's part of our factory settings. So there's an unfolding of them that this is an essay answer already. So I won't bore you with that, but there are these things that layer on top of each other so that by the time we get to late adolescence, early young adulthood, even though our brain is still maturing into the late 20s, early 30s, we can always practice them more or do better, and they're not perfect. It doesn't mean the relapse rate for self-regulation difficulties is 100%. We will procrastinate. We will be late. We will forget to set the alarm for the next day. However, the thing with ADHD, it's a matter of degree. More people with ADHD have more problems more frequently with a greater set, with a greater degree of difficulty and life difficulties. There's a quote by Edmund Burke. I think it was like an 18th century politician, philosopher, who said something along the lines of, it's hard to define where day turns into night, but it most definitely happens. That's like people, like the diagnostic line for ADHD. It's really hard to define. There's no test for ADHD or anything like that. But at some point, it crosses a line. And it's not like there's this definitive line out there like defining sunset. But at least for clinicians, where the diagnostic criteria are fulfilled, and somebody is feeling the pain from this collection of symptoms that are getting in the way of life roles, despite somebody's effort to change. And that can also be very severe, complex cases where people also have depression, anxiety, other things, and maybe losing jobs, relationships, bankruptcy, whatever. Some people might have more circumscribed difficulties. They're doing okay at work, but their marriage and relationships are failing. However you define pain, just like we can have physical pain where somebody goes, this is really distracting and I have limited movement and somebody else is bedridden with it. But I would say within that, under that umbrella, all are worthy of personalized treatment. So these are all the factors that go into what can get in the way of people seeking help for ADHD, because we'll hear from other people, well, doesn't everybody have a little ADHD? Tax season is coming up the time we're talking, and people will go, yeah, I wanted to get started this weekend, but I kept putting it off. Yes, we will all have that, but that is that dimensionality. And what I was saying is there was that recent published peer review study in a professional journal giving some confirmation that seems to be the case, that these executive functions, I'm using this like a bell-shaped curve, which describe a lot of human qualities like height. We will have NBA players, 7-footers out there that are on the outlier, the upper 1 or 2% of height in the population. We probably have another group in the top 5 to 6% who are like 6'5", 6'6". And then within the average range, we might be upwards of 6'3", or 6'4", or the lower end of what's considered the average range. Like I'm about 5'6", 5'7". Let's just say that's the other end, where we'd say, yeah, I stand next to somebody 6'4". You will tell a difference immediately, but we're all within the average range. And then something below the 5'6", whatever in height, we would say that these people are shorter than average. And it goes down to, whatever the lowest heights would be. And that's the same thing with executive functions. But with ADHD, that's where we're talking like it's the NBA of executive functioning difficulties as an analogy.
You mentioned a few things I would like to touch upon, more shame. And also if we talk about the stigma, I mean, the difficulties when it comes to, I wouldn't call it overcompensating, but what a lot of people with ADHD have to do to kind of seem like they can function as an average person can. A lot of that stigma and all that for that is because society isn't really set up for people with ADHD. From at least what I've experienced, I mean, I have ADHD. It's always been super, super difficult. But I wonder if that society not being set up for people with ADHD has also raised awareness on people understanding that there might be something going on with them, like an underlying factor that they – and then they go and research it and find out that they do have undiagnosed ADHD or they might have something. I'm sure there's probably overdiagnosis of people doing it online for themselves. But there's been a giant awareness I've seen in the past 5 years or so of ADHD being an actual name that people at least know of and don't just think it's fantasy stuff.
Right, right. No, when we started the ADHD program back in 99, Yeah, you know, even then, it was about the mid-90s, and probably the book Driven to Distraction brought newfound attention to ADHD in children and adolescents, but also that and the book You Mean I'm Not Lazy, Stupid, or Crazy was another one around the same time, which I think that title still resonates because that's a lot of the internal dialogue a lot of adults with ADHD would have before the diagnosis. Those two sort of put adult ADHD on the map. But I think you're right. Overall, and it seems like especially since the pandemic, a couple things there. One, there's an increased awareness of mental health and the availability of treatment remotely for a lot of people working from home who might have finally had time not having to commute to the offices during lockdown and being able to avail themselves of services, including individuals with ADHD. So I think those two things, and also a lot of at least the adjustment struggles, a lot of, I'll just say neurotypicals might have had adapting to work from home, especially if they had children at home, and the newfound organizational demands that people might have adapted to, I think shed new light, and people maybe getting a little sense of, like some of my ADHD clients said during the lockdown and adjusting to work from home and school from home, now people know what it's been like for me every day. Almost like having to define work and you have all the distractions with you at home where you could work long into the evening, even though that might not be healthy. So I think there's been a lot more recognition. Also, with the increased demands of technology, there's a lovely book out there called The Extended Mind. And it's not specific to ADHD, but it's by Annie Murphy Paul. And it is just about the limits of what we can do inside our cranium with our brain, how much externalization we use, writing things down, ways to get started on things, the struggles that all people have. What I also like about it, it also sheds light on the notion of an open office space has been a colossal failure, because even though it's good to coordinate with other workers, we need time alone to consolidate the information and do our own thinking about it and be creative and things like that. So it's actually working against what it was trying to achieve. And it's also, like many things, if it was bad for everybody, it's much worse for somebody with ADHD having all those distractions around. All that to say, I think it's trending in a positive way. So ADHD is out there more. You're right that there was a review of information on some social media outlets. And I think they found, I think the number was, there was only about 22% of the content was credible or by credible sources. The vast majority of it is just unreliable, we'll say. Yeah, exactly. So I think there's more awareness of it. And the thing about executive functioning coping strategies that are central to at least the psychosocial treatment for ADHD, the cognitive behavioral therapy, ADHD coaching, other things, helping academic support for college students with ADHD, it works for everybody. So I found myself, you know, some of the skills and strategies I've written about and help folks with, I use them myself to good benefit. So I think that matter of degree, people are seeing, like, in the context of work, school, home life, and relationships, some of the fixes, some of the supports aren't that elaborate. A little more time, following up, giving instructions with written instructions so something doesn't get lost in translation. You know, some extended deadlines, are realizing when deadlines are just historic deadlines or not really necessary. Does this really have, if I get this by Friday at 5, am I really going to look at it over the weekend, or could somebody get it to me by Monday, first thing Monday? Not that you necessarily want to do work over the weekend, but if it's necessary, some flexibility that can benefit everybody, including things like flexible work hours. And one of the points there is, you know, I mentioned school, work, you know, relationships, other settings, co-parenting. That's part of why do humans have executive functions to the degree that we do? Well, it came from living in larger and larger groups of non-genetically related humans in independent, at the time, very small groups, maybe less than 100 people where you knew everybody, but you had to rely on everybody for the hunt, for hunting, gathering, eventually it became farming, child rearing, division of labor, and all the things that we think of now in society. But being able to work and play well with others, remember to do things, remember promises you owe somebody else so that you have a good reputation. Also being able to pick up when you can't trust somebody and their reputation. So all these things get carried forward into the here and now. And I also think that relationship component of what many adults with ADHD deal with day to day, and even going back to the masking. Now, this is something I've been writing about more recently, and this is just my opinion. But when we think about guilt and shame that we often, and stigma, words we often hear, I hear people with adult ADHD and probably other ages too describe. These are social emotions. And there are things like gratitude and pride, which are social emotions. Gratitude, I'm really grateful somebody helped me, so I want to return the favor. Or pride, I did something to help other people, or I did something that means something to other people. I have that good feeling that makes me want to do it more. There are the, I don't like calling them the negative, because they're important to have, but the unpleasant emotions. Pain is an unpleasant feeling, is an unpleasant emotion or sensation. But we'd be a lot worse off if we didn't have it, because we'd be walking around with third degree sunburn, like with tacks in our shoes and things like that. It's good. It's a signal that lets us know, oh, I better rest my knee and not run today or things like that. Shame and guilt. If we want to, they often get used interchangeably. Shame is the perception that you've not met a community standard or done something. You know, very often we hear about shame. I can't look other people in the eye, or we avert the gaze because we violated community standard or our community standard. And this could be being caught cheating. It could be stuff that are humans doing human stuff. Some people describe it as, oh, I got a DUI. I feel so ashamed and things like that. It could be cheating on a partner, but very often adults with ADHD, it's like, I always feel ashamed when I walk in late to a meeting. Sure, you want to be on time, and that might be something to work on, but that's a very strong emotion. But it probably comes from the social element of the executive functions. Then guilt is either the actuality or the perception that we've done something wrong or wronged somebody else. We forget a promise. We break something that somebody lent to us. We don't show up for a meeting that we agreed to show up on. So the guilt is like pain. That is a signal for, oh, I have to make amends, apologize, things like that. And also there can be levels of guilt, like committing a crime or whatever the case may be, where there are some effects of that. But usually what we're talking about, and it's not unimportant, but things like showing up late for the meeting, being late with things, other work, maybe talking in class, other things which, you know, may violate certain norms within the classroom or things like that, or other social get-togethers, not letting somebody else speak like I'm doing to you during this podcast. But usually a question I'll ask people, well, what level of offense, even if you did something, is this like a felony, a misdemeanor, or is this a parking ticket? Or jaywalking, something that you can acknowledge but still make amends. But this is also what I see with a lot of adults with ADHD, maybe from the accumulation of saying, well, I was always the late person, or the teacher would point me out in class to say, why can't you just wait to be called on? You always call out instead of raising your hand, or other things that might even come up with peer relationships, like when kids might not follow the rules for a game or want to do it differently, but then eventually they say, no, if we tag you out, you're out. You have to go sit on the bench or whatever the case may be, have a hard time turn taking. These things accumulate over time and can get into the emotional and the belief systems that affects or are carried forward by adults with ADHD and can carry forward into adolescence, even adult relationships, or there can be things that happen at those times that are very powerful but painful learning experiences. I'm not doing service to some of the many positive things that can happen, like somebody finding the right coach and finding a skill in athletics or music or other creativity or a class they really like. They're not good at math or other things, but they're really good at history, something that draws them, or whatever the case may be. But we're usually focusing on the people who could benefit from treatment and seeking help. And you mentioned even that first diagnosis of ADHD. Sometimes that is the first mental, cognitive, or belief shift for the person, where they go, now there's a reason for me to understand all these difficulties that I had before, which were me thinking I was broken or somehow less than. Going back to that book I mentioned, you mean I'm not stupid, lazy, or crazy? Because very often I got to be lazy. Why do I always wait till the last minute? No, you wait till the last minute because of these executive functioning difficulties. And one of the lines in the field, ADHD is not your fault, but it is your responsibility. Now, the responsibility doesn't mean you have to tough it out and go it alone. It may be asking for help, accepting treatment, accepting accommodations. I need to check in with my boss on Friday to make sure I'm up to date and update them on my progress, because it helps me have that check-in, that deadline every week, whereas other people might be able to track and update the boss every quarter or something like that. But that's that individualization. And I think in society we're seeing, yeah, this isn't going to cost more money. It might be a little time cost of an extra meeting on a Friday. But if the overarching benefit is that worker gets to focus now more on their strengths with just a one hour a week check-in, I think there's a lot of modifications to the workplace, school, and other places that aren't going to undo the essence of what the expectations are.
What are healthy coping mechanisms and what are unhealthy coping mechanisms that people do who might suffer shame or some type of emotional kind of, I wouldn't say outburst, but emotional kind of response to either trauma or something? For instance, if we talked about shame, I would have to pinpoint a lot of that to being childhood based. I don't really see a whole lot of adults that are dealing with like getting made fun of or things of that sort, but that's a common school childhood problem when some kid won't stop talking or starts becoming annoying. And I would just think you would evolve coping mechanism skills based on your experiences in early youth and take it into adulthood with you. But some of the unhealthy ones I have is like isolation, which comes with a large amount of shame.
That's the first one I was going to bring up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and also even let's not underestimate, because sometimes things are done in adulthood, maybe even well-meaning. There was a paper by, I really admire her work, Diane Beaton. And I forget the institution she's with in the UK. She's looked at criticisms reported by adults with ADHD. Now, the number one overarching source of criticism is from the inattentive domain, which probably bundles in, yes, focus, listening, eye contact, but probably also bundles in lateness, procrastination, forgetting to follow through on things. And the number one in the social domain is impulsivity. Maybe saying the wrong thing, talking over other people, missing social cues. So there may be some things like somebody showing up late for meetings, and maybe even somebody's friend, a person, let's just say it was a person with ADHD showing up late, saying, hey, you're on Jamie time. And it maybe gets a little laugh, but the person, you know, it's in the eye of the beholder. Do they take it as well-meaning? And yeah, I know. And it's something I'm working on. And it's sort of open. And, or is it somebody going, yes, I know, but I hate the attention being drawn to me. So there can be, you know, within ADHD, there can be different temperaments where somebody's more outgoing and whatever, and they can roll with it. And, you know, sort of self-deprecating humor. But that's how they work. And it's part of their good people skills. Somebody else could be like a turtle going into the shell saying, you know what, maybe I'll skip the next meeting because I don't want to show up late. But then that magnifies the difficulty. It's a short-term coping. I don't want to face hearing Jamie time again. But then it's like, all right, and this is impulsivity too. I didn't think that later on I have to see the supervisor or the boss who asked me, why weren't you at the meeting? And either am I honest about it, or you know, another mechanism is lying sometimes. Somebody's late with a project, they call out sick when they're not sick as a face saving, you know, mechanism. So that can be some of the other unhealthy things, because we've all done it, and you know, often we get away with it, but sometimes these things start magnifying, or then the person, they still don't get the project done. So avoidance, withdrawing can be unhealthy, including, well, embedded in that, I'm a cognitive behavioral therapist. The cognitive speaks to our mindsets, how we think about things, interpret things. And we can have automatic thoughts. Like I could have the automatic, Robbie must be really bored right now. And it could be accurate. And
I'm learning a lot.
Well, mind reading, you know, it comes from a good place. It's our capacity for empathy. Like if I saw you get up and walk around and you stubbed your toe, I might wince, even though I didn't feel any pain, but I go, oh, that's got to hurt. But even if we know people like our spouse or our children or coworkers, we're never perfect at reading them. But very often adults with kids and teens, but you know, focus on adults here. They may have learned from, they might've had some past experiences like, well, when I skipped the class, the professor said that's disrespectful. Or somebody else said, well, that's disrespectful. And then that gets internalized a little bit, or getting negative feedback, like somebody looking, you know, dramatically looking at the watch when somebody shows in late, or even the unintentional eye rolls or heavy sighs, all these verbal, nonverbal cues that people pick up on, because, you know, these are other ways we have of communicating. And sometimes it's intentional. And it can be positive. We nod when we hear things we like, or we smile when something can be positively reinforcing. But sometimes these are reflexes. And these are things that can get internalized by a lot of adults with ADHD. One of the other terms out there in ADHD land related to what we're talking about here. So we're talking about some of the unhealthy coping strategies. And sometimes these are just the responses that can be natural responses, but they can nudge us in a negative direction. So it's not like somebody says, you know, I'm going to insult this person, or I'm going to make a political joke about one party, not knowing that they're a member of that party or something. I'm going to do that intentionally. It could be something later on, but then the strategy is, oh, I can't look that person in the face, or they're going to hate me or whatever. So that might be a reflex. It's not something somebody's doing, okay, I really want to ruin this friendship. But one of the things that can be a part of that is what's known as the term, it's been out there for a while. It's called rejection sensitive dysphoria. Now, this is something like, within ADHD world, what started off as sluggish cognitive tempo, that was renamed concentration deficit, that is now called cognitive disengagement syndrome. So it's not an official thing, but it's sort of a cousin of ADHD, and it's sort of, instead of hyperactivity, hypoactivity, but difficulties focusing, but it seems to be orienting in the first place, maybe being more slower processing speed that sometimes goes along with ADHD. So I just use that as an example of something. There's no diagnostic code for that. There's probably some experts studying it right now, and it may turn into a thing like a learning issue or whatnot. Another thing that's not a thing is imposter syndrome. That's not an official thing, but it's something that captures something that resonates for everybody. Now, that can come from an identified female working in a predominantly male field where there's not a lot of role models for what to do, or you feel like the outsider, or an identified male working in a predominantly female field where it's, you know, not a role model, or somebody who's first generation US, first generation in college, whatever, who just doesn't have role models and sort of feels out of place and wondering, when are they going to find out that I'm a fraud? I think of rejection sensitive dysphoria like that. It comes up in depression, where somebody who's depressed, then all of a sudden they're more sensitive to actual or perceived rejection by others, maybe seeing it where it's not there and reacting to it though, like it's there. It can come up in certain personality styles and things like that. So it's a thing out there, but it can show up in a bunch of different ways. But Dr. Bill Dodson, William Dodson, a Colorado-based psychiatrist, has been the one who's really popularized this and brought it to the fore with various examples. With ADHD, I just take the D off to say, rather than having it be a thing, let's talk about rejection sensitivity, because with ADHD, we're talking about individuals with a greater likelihood of experiencing many public-facing frustrations. Like one of my clients as an adult, when she was talking about her response in school when she was called on, she said, my first response was usually, huh, what? Followed by giggles. Or the person getting called on, looking out the window, who is brought back from a daydream. And this can happen in the workplace too. People, somebody staring, you know, just lost in their thoughts and get called out on it or whatever the case is. These things that the giggles can sear into them. So more likely to have public-facing difficulties at work, walking in, forgetting that today's the day you were supposed to do the presentation and you're not prepared, or showing up a month early for your dentist visit, thinking, oh, I thought it was February 1st, not March 1st, or whatever the case may be. But these things add up over time. So we have individuals who are more likely to experience a cluster of these things, experience them more often and in diverse situations and with greater degree of negative feedback from others. And even if it's not intentionally negative, like getting suspended at work or detentions at school, but just responses that hurt. Also, ADHD, even though it's not in that official list of 18 symptoms, emotional regulation is one of the executive functions. Being able to downregulate upset emotions or overreactions, including being overexcited, being able to rein that in enough. And not that, oh, you can't be too happy, but this would be the kid jumping the line at the pinata at the birthday party, jumping the line, or somebody who has to get some work done the Friday before a long weekend, a holiday weekend, who just can't get focused. Now they're stuck doing work over the weekend to meet the Tuesday deadline or something like that. Being able to say, okay, you know what, 5 o'clock vacation starts, but let me get focused on work, but also upregulation. Feel enough like studying for the midterm 3 days from now rather than the night before, when nobody in their right mind is going to feel like studying 3 days ahead of time. So the emotional regulation piece with upset feelings, and also buying time so we can keep the situation in perspective, even though for individuals with ADHD, they're going to have a different perspective. Very often with classic cognitive behavioral therapy, say for somebody who's depressed, I use the example, a college student comes in and says, Dr. Ramsey, I've got to leave college. I'm not cut out for this. Well, how come? What happened? I got a C on the midterm, and that's the lowest grade I've ever gotten. I'm going to fail out of college. Well, how are your grades? You know, so far, so good, but this is the first C I'm going to fail out. Well, not going to fail out, but let's think about your expectations for college, and this is the first college test you took. Let's rein it in. You're not going to fail. You're upset that you got a low grade. Are there things you can do differently? Things like that, problem solving, and okay, don't have to worry about failing out of college. Somebody with ADHD might come in and say, yeah, I failed the test. I'm worried you're going to fail the class, fail out of school. What evidence do you have? They might've said, well, I also failed the first two tests in the semester. So there might be the actual experience of, I am at risk for failing. And maybe if their grades are such that maybe they will have to take a leave of absence or incompletes or whatever. Not that that is the death sentence, or not that that means they're going to have to leave college, but it's different. The person's coming in with, I'm having these experiences. Now, very often it's because they haven't adapted how they got through high school to how they're studying for college, the personalization of skills, and also underestimating, this goes back to the interpersonal piece, underestimating reaching out for help out of a sense of guilt or shame. I failed. How can I look the professor in the eye? Or I missed classes leading up to the midterm. Now, these are issues that might have to be dealt with, but still the professor, student learning services, Office of Student Disabilities, tutoring services, TA, there might be support resources out there, but this is where this rejection sensitivity can circle back and say, No, I and having thoughts like I can't do this because I was late so often, the professor's going to be angry. And this whole story, I always tell clients, I'm duty bound to say this is statistically possible that your professor could have that reaction or not grant you an extension or say, no, there's no way you can put, even if you get 100% on the final, you won't pass the class. So I recommend you drop the class. But it may not be the worst case scenario. But still, this hits pretty hard for anybody, but especially adults with ADHD. So these are some of these examples about how the avoidance and withdrawal, including, seeking help, because there's an increased expectation of independent functioning in adulthood, but independence doesn't mean solo. It means utilizing resources like tutors, TAs, help at work, asking a colleague for help, as seeking out a therapist or a coach or a psychiatrist or, other help. But I think, withdrawal, like I said, when you said it, I would say that would be the number one. And a lot of people end up and isolating from other people. The world can start to get really small. And that's where the depression and anxiety that so often go along with ADHD can come in. And the feeling like I can't reach out to others. I was working, actually, I'm still working with him. He had some of these experiences early on. And like you said, it was in school and some teachers who, oh, you don't care if you cared more, things like that. It wasn't a matter of caring. It was unidentified ADHD. And but also some of this stuff persisted into adulthood where he worked. But he would describe himself in dealing with people who weren't in his inner circle who got him. He described himself as always bracing, going into a situation, tensing up, waiting for. Am I going to walk into the room and everybody's already been there for half an hour? Or is somebody going to point out something I so obviously did wrong? Had some experiences of it, probably far outweighed by his skills and gifts, but it was always there because what's the phrase? Burn me once, shame on you. Burn you, burn me twice, shame on me. But the shame on me is usually people, and that very gentleman I'm talking about, once he got the diagnosis and medications, CBT, some other supports, he's really gravitated and found more people who get him and is actually, he was doing really well before, but now he's an all-star. But it was getting to that point where saying, just because everybody doesn't get me doesn't mean I'm wrong. And can I find people, including neurotypicals, who go, hey, I like how you work and what you have is valuable. And another thing he does nice sometimes now, he's like an advocate for himself and he wants to be an advocate for others. He'll, like, if somebody's like, let's just say he can get a really serious voice when he's talking about his work. And somebody said, yo, don't, you don't have to be angry. He has a nice phrase to introduce something. Hey, here's my public service announcement. When I get serious, I get really focused and intense. It doesn't mean I'm angry, but it's just I get serious and I want to make sure I'm clearly expressing myself because I have some attention issues. So I want to make sure my thoughts are clear and you're understanding them. And those little things, this is my PSA, my public service announcement, is his way of entering it in. But I think going back to, I think we are moving in more positive directions. This is more understood. And something I said before, a lot of these things could be helpful for a lot of people, including. Things that post-pandemic, if we are post-pandemic, I think we are, but things like hybrid work arrangements. Some people with ADHD do great with that. Other people say, no, I do better with the structure of the office, being away from all my entertainment center and all that stuff.
I wanted to ask because you mentioned it, at least a few examples, but how much do you put on people, like other people, helping out when it comes to certain areas with understanding the stigma of ADHD? I mean, obviously, there is still kind of a stigma there, even though it seems like every time I go online, maybe it's my algorithm, but ADHD definitely seems a lot more like everyone's aware of it now. But when someone is experiencing that pain, that shame, and they can't necessarily deal with some of the problems themselves, because a lot of it might be just their environment that's around them. I mean, how can an average person, someone who might not have ADHD, make it comfortable? And how much do you put in as that being a major contributing factor? How much do you weigh into the person with ADHD? It's their responsibility compared to the people around them.
Right. First off, and I've heard this from other places. There's a lot of these things you can ask for, especially if you're not sure of your audience, meaning I'm not sure how my boss would take this if, excuse me, I go in saying I have ADHD. There's a lot of things you can ask for. And you know what? And in line with this, one of the other coping strategies I think is underutilized in ADHD is assertiveness and self-advocacy, which can be done nicely. I'm as conflict avoidant as anybody else. So it's a, like a behavioral, you know, coming up with some steps that you can do, including sometimes assertiveness is restating facts as we see them. Excuse me, I think I ordered French fries with my sandwich, not potato chips. That's my go-to for it. But you could go, you know what, I know I have a hard time getting to the office in time. There's a lot of things I'm dealing with in the morning. I'm wondering if I could adjust my schedule to arrive at 10 a.m. and I can stay at the office till 6 p.m. That way we have more coverage in the evening and we could try this on for 3 months, see how it works. Now, the reason for coming in at 10 a.m. could be childcare. It could be having a hard time getting up and out the door in the morning and waiting for the morning medications to kick in. There's a lot of things we can ask for. Or I have a hard time staying on top of and organizing long-term deadlines. Is it okay if we set up the Friday meeting where I can review my progress and get feedback and get any questions answered by you? Are you willing to do that, boss, supervisor, person? Again, you don't have to say the letters ADHD. So there's ways to do it stealth if you're not sure what the response would be. In terms of other people, it depends. For young adults, you know, in college or even in the workplace, there may be very invested parents paying tuition or whatnot who want to be supportive. And so with the, because very often the young adult, if they're 18 or more or older, they have full confidentiality, treatment confidentiality as an adult, regardless if somebody else is paying for it. Now, very often they'll say, yes, you can speak with my parents about billing issues. And very often they'll agree to having a group meeting with the parents or part of the evaluation. It can be helpful too, where there's some psychoeducation about ADHD. And if your son, daughter forgets to do something, it's not intentionally forgetting it or, you know, things like that. They have a difficulty time tracking. Here's how we work on it. Here's how you can be supportive. But here's also things that maybe as parents, you want to not follow up with and let the therapist follow up with if it becomes headbutting. Or this might be particularly with a spouse or life partner or, you know, anybody, you know, living together who it wants to get educated a little bit about what ADHD is and isn't. And also, you know, very often the partner will say, I don't want to be my partner's parent. That's like the antithesis of, but they feel the antithesis of a loving, physically affectionate relationship. But they feel like I have to double check things and things like that. So there may be ways even within the relationship to set up some check-ins, not everything. Did you floss today and things like that? But some of the bigger things, including renegotiating like the chores around the house. If the person with ADHD really isn't good at income taxes or whatever, maybe the other partner is willing to take that on, and maybe the partner with ADHD is better at hands-on stuff like mowing the lawn, unloading the dishwasher, things where they can see the progress. It's more bounded tasks rather than more high cognitive load tasks like working on taxes, things like that. Or maybe both of them go, neither of them like it, so we will take some of our money and hire an accountant. But that collaborative problem solving, and it's not the stuff of rom-coms, but couples who have those sorts of discussions and also part of the check-ins, okay, I need you to pick me up at the train station on Thursday because the car is going in for inspection. Let's make sure it's on the Google calendar and reminding them the morning of. That collaborative problem solving, and hopefully the check-in meetings end with like some relationship activity, like going for a walk, watching a show together. That's intimate communication. Yes, it's not like reading Shakespeare to each other, but it's intimacy about something that's important for one partner. Yeah, I'm not good at this. And being able to say, hey, let's work together to make it better. And also there can be a back and forth. Maybe the non-ADHD partner goes, here's a chore. I don't like mowing the lawn. It's like, okay, I'll do that. And so, and there are some mentoring relationships, like somebody with a dissertation chair, or sometimes bosses might be open about their own ADHD. And there might be some cues. Now, I did hear in a professional presentation of somebody saying, You know what? There's some guidance out there about stating that you have ADHD during the job interview, but I've heard more advice recently about.
But why do you bring it up? That's for me.
Well, that's what I was going to say. That's increasing. I think the old view was if you want to be petition potentially for formal workplace accommodations, bring it up earlier on. That way you're open about it and things like that. But there could be like conscious or unconscious bias about that or whatever. Now, somebody with ADHD might not get the job because somebody else has 20 years experience in that job. It's not always because of that. But the increased advice I've heard from people in the field. Now, other people may disagree with this, so take this with a grain of salt. But, don't bring it up. Don't go to HR right away. See if you can do like informal things. Like I mentioned, the arriving at 10, leaving at 6, things like that. Informal accommodations, because a lot of these don't cost any money. They're just more time investments. There may be certain institutions or larger workplaces or academic institutions where maybe there's a more formalized process that you can rely on to say, yes, if you need an accommodation. And this could be the same for a sensory disability. If somebody like loses their sight or loses hearing in one ear or something, some accommodations and maybe some technology stuff. I think before a lot of this was, there were accommodations like voice to text software that were really at the time, I've been doing this for a while, that were really new and you'd have to buy and purchase, that now are part of many software. Like, I won't use a brand name, not that I'm talking about a medication, but I typically use software or apps or whatever, where it's part of the basic features. So it's not this foreign and it's going to cost the business money. So I think there's a lot of workarounds reaching out to individuals, not using ADHD, but also loved ones very often want to, hey, how can I be supportive and what are resources out there that I can learn about ADHD? I think there are, for couples with ADHD, there are some good resources out there written for the partner of somebody with ADHD to better understand. And yeah, I mentioned the automatic thoughts. Very often things like, I'll still hear it secondhand that there's some very good therapists, marital therapists, or relationship therapists out there who are familiar with ADHD and know how to navigate it. But sometimes you'll hear some therapists. Now I hear the secondhand. But I'll hear like, I'm very often seeing the partner with ADHD and maybe their partner's going into couples therapy. And my partner's therapist said, if I really cared about my partner, I would pay the bill on time, or, I wouldn't talk over, or I wouldn't do whatever. And that's that old school neurotypical view. And I'd even say it's probably like a faulty claim there, but take that with a grain of salt.
Well, just one last question for you, but when it comes to the conversation of ADHD, what do you think is the most important that people should keep in their minds when discussing ADHD, but also understanding ADHD? That's an on-the-spot question. I'm sorry for that, but it's good.
No, I'm prioritizing in my head. In terms of understanding, now there could be exceptions to this, but I would say generally, one, the person with ADHD, for lack of a better phrase, wants to do the right thing or wants the same thing you want. It's not working against each other. It's not trying to get out of something. It's whatever. And I'd say a corollary of that, wants the same thing you do, but struggles with many of the steps that go into achieving it, and just will do it different than you do. So there's a difference there that's not intentional, and you both want the same thing. You're on the same page. Because that's where the thing, like, if your partner cared about you, they would pay the bill on time, as they promised. A late bill, late fees, that's real world stuff. Yeah. But maybe it's, we haven't adapted this, or maybe the partner with ADHD promised something. They want the same thing. Even the kid in school who says, when am I going to need calculus outside of school? they still want to get their homework done. They still want to pass the course. They still don't want to have to sweat over, did I pass the exam, or hearing about things. Even if they go, I'm never going to have to use this again, but they still want to do what everybody wants to do well and at least get a pat on the back. So that would be the one thing to, for people without ADHD to understand. I forget the other side. What would be important to communicate?
Well, just what people with ADHD, what's one important thing if anybody's listening out there that has ADHD to understand the importance of kind of understanding it better? I mean, there's many things we can focus on when it comes to ADHD about just trying to make things easier for everyone, even people who are with someone with ADHD and someone that has ADHD. But there's always a takeaway in someone's mind of like what they would consider a main factor. For me, I would look at more of like people with ADHD, the masking stuff. I don't see it being healthy at all. I think it ends up, I mean, I'm 26 years old and I can tell you the isolation stuff is not something that's a good quality symptom in having a functioning adult.
Right. Yeah. And even the masking is tiring because it's a high cognitive load task. Now, coping with ADHD and some of the extra steps that may be required is also a high cognitive load. But you know, one of the things, and it doesn't exactly answer the question, but this could be something else to communicate to somebody else, because sometimes like one of the myths out there, oh, these are people looking for an easy way out or whatever, they don't want to do the work. No, like one of my colleagues said, you know, very often adults with ADHD are working twice as hard for half as much. But even in that mode, all they want to do is get done, keep up, or just know that, okay, the work will be accepted, I'll pass the course. Or you know, it's not like I want to be CEO or I have to have it done my way. It's just like I want to know I'm in the ballpark of what I need to do and that what I'm doing is enough. So going back to like things to hold on to, there are millions of people like you. And you know, going back to that bell-shaped curve, and it's hard to tell where day turns into night, but it most decidedly happens. There are a lot of neurotypicals near you too, who even if they don't have ADHD might wonder about it or sort of go, oh yeah, I'm not good at that too. So it's not unfamiliar. And that with the supports we have, the top ones being medications, psychosocial treatments, cognitive behavioral therapy for adult ADHD, at least is defined by Division 12 Clinical Psychology of the American Psychological Association, which you know deems some of these things as an evidence-supported treatment. It's passed at adequate research. Adult ADHD coaching is something out there that has a lot of research behind it. And can be, I would say, can be considered evidence supported. There's some concerns about how quickly people can get trained and the evidence out there, but there's a lot of very good training organizations and credentialing out there. So you might have to do a little more, you know, research. But that's one of the things. Like adult ADHD is still a niche specialty. But some of the coaching also, a lot of the research was done with college students. And I always said before, if I was an adult ADHD coach, I'd be finding a campus to work at or near, because it can very much help with organizing academics and follow through. Some educators, when talking about ADHD and executive functions, say getting through college is half IQ, what you know, and half executive functions, you know, being able to organize and follow through on things. Because every student with ADHD met the application criteria, the acceptance criteria for the school. It's the doing it. ADHD is a performance problem, not a knowledge problem. That could be another takeaway. But all this to say, another heartening thing, there are many supports out there. You know, it's right of self-determination. If you don't want to take medications, try the psychosocial treatments. If you say, I don't have time for weekly or every other week visits and, you know, the coaching and CBT can be flexible in terms of scheduling for whatever reasons. And, you know, medications, I mean, they are highly effective. They're among the safest and most effective, at the very least, in all psychiatry, if not all medicine. And all the treatments I cited here have very good success rates. Now, again, the executive functions, the relapse rate is 100%. Even with all the right coping strategy, I'll tell my clients who might be feeling, oh, I can't believe I messed this up again. I'll say, I can tell you all the things I plan to do this weekend that I didn't get to, but it can move forward in a generally positive, not a generally positive way, a positive way. And the analogy I use for this, let's just say somebody says, yeah, I probably procrastinate on 4 out of every 5 things I plan to do. And through medications, coaching, CBT, whatever else you use, let's just say you get that up to 3 out of, you follow through now on 3 out of 5 things. So we've gone from 20 to 60% follow through. If we invented a medication that had those results, we're billionaires. People are lining up outside of this. They're putting it into drinking water. But the individual with ADHD will most likely go to, yeah, I'm still failing 4 out of 5 times. So it is normalizing the imperfection of our human brain. But that's why we have these coping strategies. And I mentioned that mind reading before, looking at everybody else and how easy they have it and how together they are. No, it's procrastination is ubiquitous. 20%, at least of the US population, probably has, not probably, on the data, has problematic procrastination. Now, there's probably an overrepresentation of adults with ADHD in there, but it doesn't capture everybody. So some of these are familiar and, you know, everybody's got something, but it's a way to sort of normalize and say it's okay to seek out help and coping skills and including the connection with a helper who gets it and can help you rebound in that resilience. And, you know, one of the, with cognitions, within cognitive therapy, there's what's called the cognitive theme. What's the cognitive theme of depression? Well, the cognitive theme of depression is a sense of loss. And that could be, oh, I didn't get the job interview, or I didn't get the grade I was looking for, or I, you know, a breakup of a relationship, or, you know, something where that feeling is sort of letting go of a goal. And so we can gear up and get some of that, at least, you know, adaptive loss that can turn into sadness, can turn into depression. And that's a different thing. The core theme of anxiety is a sense of risk and intolerance of uncertainty. I know this will probably be okay, but I'm not 100% sure. So I avoid it. And that's how we get. And I was asked one time many years ago, what's the cognitive theme of adult ADHD? And I didn't have an answer at the time. So my last book was a book length answer to that. And it's a sense of my conjecture. It doesn't have evidence behind it yet, but it's self-mistrust. I know I can do it, but I can't trust myself that I'll reliably do it when I need to do it. So, like, I know what I need to do, but I just don't do it, at least all the time. Sometimes it's great, but I don't know if I'll be able to do it to the same level tomorrow. And I think one of the other things is building up more self-trust, including the trust of knowing when you will invariably slip up. You will, Robbie, I will, Russ, everybody listening to this will slip up periodically, but it's how do we get back to do it and decreasing some of the unpleasant emotions, or at least, you know, using them dose dependent. If we mess up with a friend, yeah, we want to have a smidge of guilt that makes us go, I'm sorry, let me make it up to you. That is healthy guilt, and we don't want to lose that.
Russell, is there a place where people can find any of your links to your website, any book links, Amazon links?
Oh, yeah. Well, probably the best place to go is my website. It's www.cbt, as in Thomas, number4adhd.com. Sometimes people hear CBD for ADHD and get really excited, but it's not that. It's cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, the letter CBT, number4adhd.com.
Now I'll make sure
everything's there. Books, podcast link, probably a link to our last one that's gotten some positive feedback on, and a host of other things, including some of the ADHD organizations that can, that's another sense of community and support. Because many of the, like Chad, at least a local Chad chapter near me, has like monthly adult ADHD support groups, virtual support groups. So there is a community out there, and like some of the national conferences, very often it's a mixture of professionals, experts in the field, but also people with ADHD, their loved ones, wanting to have a sense of community, but also get the most up-to-date information. And also looking forward to, in a broader sense, the American Professional Society of ADHD and Related Disorders is moving ahead with the first U.S. adult ADHD diagnosis and treatment guidelines. There's been very wonderful international ones, but moving ahead with the ADHD ones and CHAD, children and adults with ADHD. There's a work group that I'm part of as the psychosocial treatment representative that we're going to take the guidelines and for various professions like psychiatry, neurology, nurse practitioners, going to come up with clinical toolkits for people in those professions, like guiding them and how to make decisions and how to move ahead and support adults with ADHD. So that's coming up over the next couple of years.
Well, Russell, I'm going to link all your links in the description for people to be able to click and check it out. I appreciate the time again, and thanks. Right.
And Robbie, I appreciate what you've done to shed light on this and being an advocate for folks out there. So I hope people appreciate the steps you took bringing me in. There's a lot of other good voices out there, but I appreciate all the time you put into this and all the care you give to it.
I appreciate the time you've done with all the research you've done and giving me the time to talk about it. But I'm going to link all your links in the description. It's been a pleasure chatting, and thanks everybody for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank. Stay tuned for next episode.